With millions of viewers watching, this expert praised the health value of McDonald's hamburgers. It's no wonder that consumers around the country were confused. Only a handful of insiders could possibly know that his views did not even come close to reflecting the best understanding of the science at the time. The second meeting. We were back for round two in Atlantic City at our annual meeting in late spring of 1981. From our correspondence over the past year, the PNIC already had an informal agenda in place. First, we were to establish the proposition that nutrition scams were eroding the public's trust in the nutrition research community. Second, we needed to publicize the idea that advocating more vegetable and fruit consumption and less meat and high-fat foods was itself a scam. Third, we intended to position our committee as a permanent standing organization. Up to this point, our group had only served in a temporary capacity, as an exploratory committee. Now it was time to get on with our job of becoming the permanent principal source of reliable nutrition information in the U.S. Within the first few days of arriving at the convention, a fellow member of the committee, Howard Applebaum, told me of the developing gossip.
"Did you hear?" he whispered. "Olson's decided that they're going to reconstitute the committee, and you are going to be removed."
At that time, Olson was still serving his one-year term as president of the parent society, the American Institute of Nutrition, and had the power to do such things. I remember thinking that this news was neither surprising nor disappointing. I knew I was the black sheep of the committee, and had already stepped out of line at our inaugural meeting the previous year. My continued involvement in this particular group was going to amount to nothing more than trying to swim up Niagara Falls. The only reason I was involved in the first place was because the director of the Public Affairs Office at FASEB had secured me the spot. I had thought the first year's committee meeting was dubious, but I ran into an even more bizarre beginning at that second meeting a year later, before Olson had the chance to remove me. When the proposal to become a permanent organization within our society was put forth, I was the only one to challenge the idea. I expressed concern that this committee and its activities reeked of McCarthyism, which had no place in a scientific research society. What I was saying made the chair of the committee intensely angry and physically hostile, and I decided it was best to just leave the room. I was clearly a threat to everything the committee members wanted to achieve. After the whole ordeal was related to the newly elected incoming president, Professor Doris Calloway of UC Berkeley, the PNIC was abolished and reformed, with me as the chair. Fortunately, I persuaded our six-member committee to disband after less than a year, and the whole sorry affair came to an end. To stay and fight the good fight, so to speak, was not an option. It was early in my career, and the awesome power wielded by the senior members of my society was stark and intellectually brutal. For many of these characters, searching for a truth that promoted public health over the status quo was not an option. I am absolutely convinced that had I busied myself with tackling these issues so early in my career, I would not be writing this book. Research funding and publications would have been difficult, if not impossible, to obtain. Meanwhile, Bob Olson and some of his colleagues turned their attention elsewhere, focusing on a relatively new organization founded in 1978 called the American Council on Science and Health, ACSH. Headquartered in New York City, the ACSH bills itself, still today, as a consumer education consortium concerned with issues related to food, nutrition, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, lifestyle, the environment, and health. The group also claims to be an independent, non-profit, tax-exempt organization, but they receive 76% of their funding from corporations and corporate donors, according to the National Environmental Trust, who cite Congressional Quarterly's public interest profiles. According to the National Environmental Trust, the ACSH has claimed in their reports that cholesterol is not related to coronary heart disease. The unpopularity of food irradiation is not based in science. Endocrine disruptors, for example, PCBs, dioxins, etc., are not a human health problem. Saccharin is not carcinogenic, and implementation of fossil fuel restrictions to control global warming should not be implemented. Searching for a serious critique of the food industry from the ACSH is like searching for a needle in a haystack. Although I believe that some of their arguments may have merit, I seriously question their claim to be an objective broker of consumer education. Falling on my petard. During the entire experience with the PNIC, I continued to work on the NAS report on diet, nutrition, and cancer, which was released in June 1982. As might have been expected, when this report was published, all hell broke loose. Being the first such report on diet and cancer, it received extensive publicity, fast becoming the most sought-after report in NAS history. It was establishing high-profile goals for the dietary prevention of cancer, which were very similar to those of the 1976 McGovern Committee report on diet and heart disease. We were principally encouraging the consumption of fruits, vegetables, and whole grain cereal products, while decreasing total fat intake. The fact that this report was concerned with cancer instead of heart disease, however, elevated emotions. The stakes were high and getting higher. Cancer incites a far greater fear than heart disease. Given the stakes, some powerful enemies came out of the woodwork. Within 2 weeks, the Council on Agriculture, Science, and Technology, CAST, an influential lobbying group for the livestock-based farming industry, produced a report summarizing the views of 56 experts who were concerned about the effect of our NAS report on the agriculture and food industries. Olson, Jukes, Harper, and their like-minded colleagues on the now-defunct PNIC weighed in as experts. Their report was quickly published, then placed in the hands of all 535 U.S. congressional members. It was clear that CAST was deeply concerned about the possible impact that our report might have on the public. CAST wasn't the only group that stepped up to criticize the report. In addition, there were the American Meat Institute, National Broiler Council, National Cattlemen's Association, National Livestock and Meat Board, National Meat Association, National Milk Producers Federation, National Pork Producers Council, National Turkey Federation, and United Egg Producers. I wouldn't presume to know how much cancer research the National Turkey Federation conducts, but I'm guessing that their criticism of our report was not born out of their desire for truth in science. It was ironic that I had learned some of my most valuable lessons growing up on a dairy farm, and yet the work I was doing was portrayed as being at odds with agricultural interests. Of course, these mammoth corporate interests were far removed from the farmers I knew growing up, the hard-working, honest families that maintained small farms, just big enough to get by comfortably. I often have wondered whether these Washington agricultural interests truly represent America's great farming tradition, or whether they only represent agricultural conglomerates with operations worth tens of millions of dollars. Alf Harper, who had written a strong letter of support for my first faculty position after leaving MIT, wrote me a stern personal letter in which he declared that I had fallen on my own petard. A petard is a type of bomb or firecracker. Apparently, my involvement in the PNIC and the NAS diet, nutrition, and cancer report was finally too much for even him to bear. Times were hot, to be sure. Congressional hearings in which I testified were held on the NAS report itself. People magazine featured me in a prominent article, and an endless series of news media reports continued over the next year. American Institute for Cancer Research. It seemed that for the first time in our history, the government was seriously thinking about what we eat as a means of controlling cancer. This was fertile territory for doing something new, and something new did indeed fall into my lap. I was invited to assist a new organization called the American Institute for Cancer Research, AICR, in Falls Church, Virginia. The founders of this organization were fundraisers and had learned that it was possible to raise, through mailing campaigns, large sums of money for cancer research. It seemed that many people were interested in learning something new about cancer beyond the usual model of surgery, radiation, and cytotoxic drugs. This budding organization was well aware of our 1982 NAS report that focused on diet and cancer, and so invited me to join them as their senior science advisor. I encouraged them to focus on diet because the nutrition connection with cancer was becoming an important area of research, yet was receiving very little, if any, support from the major funding agencies. I especially encouraged them to emphasize whole foods as a source of nutrition, not nutrient supplements, partly because this was the message of the NAS report. As I began to work with the AICR, two challenges simultaneously arose. First, the AICR needed to get established as a credible organization to promote the message and support research. Second, the NAS recommendations needed to be publicized. Therefore, I thought it made sense for the AICR to help publicize the NAS recommendations. Dr. Sushma Palmer, executive director of the NAS project, and Harvard professor Mark Hegstead, who was the key advisor to the McGovern Committee, agreed to join me in endorsing this AICR project. Simultaneously, the AICR president, Marilyn Gentry, suggested that the AICR could publish the NAS report and send free copies to 50,000 physicians in the U.S. These projects, which seemed to me to be logical, useful, and socially responsible, were also highly successful. The associations we were making and the exposure we were generating were aimed at increasing the public's health. As I was quick to find out, however, creating an organization focused on diet as a central link in cancer causation was seen as a threat to a great many people. It was clear that the AICR's projects were beginning to hit the mark because of the hostile feedback coming from the food, medical, and drug industries. It seemed that every effort was being made to discredit them. I was surprised that government interference was particularly harsh. National and state attorney general offices questioned the AICR's status and its fundraising procedures. The U.S. Post Office joined in the fray, questioning whether the AICR could use the mail to spread junk information. We all had our suspicions as to who were encouraging these government offices to quash the dissemination of this diet and cancer information. Collectively, these public agencies were making life very difficult. Why were they attacking a nonprofit organization promoting cancer research? It all came down to the fact that the AICR, like the NAS, was advancing an agenda that connected diet and cancer. The American Cancer Society, ACS, became an especially vigorous detractor. In its eyes, the AICR had two strikes against it. It might compete for the same funding donors, and it was trying to shift the cancer discussion toward diet. The ACS had not yet acknowledged that diet and nutrition were connected to cancer. It wasn't until many years later, in the early 1990s, that it developed dietary recommendations to control cancer, when the idea was receiving considerable currency with the public. It was very much a medically based organization invested in the conventional use of drugs, radiation, and surgery. A short while before, the ACS had contacted our NAS committee about the possibility of our joining them to produce dietary recommendations to prevent cancer. As a committee, we declined, although a couple of the people on our committee did offer their individual services. The ACS seemed to sense a big story on the horizon, and didn't like the idea that another organization, the AICR, might get the credit. Misinformation. It may seem that I am coming down a tad harsh on an organization that most people regard as purely benevolent, but the ACS acted differently behind the scenes than it did in public. On one occasion, I traveled to an upstate New York town where I had been invited to give a lecture to the local ACS chapter, as I had done elsewhere. During my lecture, I showed a slide that made reference to the new AICR organization. I did not mention my personal association, so the audience was not aware that I was their senior science advisor. After the lecture, I took questions, and my host asked me, "Do you know that AICR is an organization of quacks?" "No," I said, "I don't." I'm afraid I didn't do such a good job of hiding my skepticism of her comment, because she felt obliged to explain. "That organization is being run by a group of quacks and discredited doctors. Some of them have even served time in prison." Prison time? This was news to me. Again, without revealing my association with the AICR, I asked, "How do you know that?" She said she saw a memo that had been circulated to local ACS offices around the country. Before leaving, I arranged for her to send me a copy of the memo she was referring to, and in a day or so, she did. The memo had been sent from the office of the national president of the ACS, who also was a senior executive of the prestigious Roswell Park Memorial Institute for Cancer Research in Buffalo. This memo alleged that the scientific chair of the organization, without naming me, was heading up a group of 8 or 9 discredited physicians, several of whom had spent time in prison. It was total fabrication. I didn't even recognize the names of these discredited physicians, and had no idea how something so vicious could have gotten started. After snooping around a little more, I discovered the person in the ACS office in Buffalo who was responsible for the memo. I phoned him. Not surprisingly, he was evasive and only said that he had gotten this information from an unnamed reporter. It was impossible to trace the original source. The one thing I do know for sure was that this memo was distributed by the office of the ACS's president. I also learned that the National Dairy Council, a powerful industry lobbying group, had obtained a copy of the same memo and proceeded to distribute a notice of its own to its local offices around the country. The smear campaign against the AICR was widespread. The food, pharmaceutical, and medical industries, through and or parallel to the ACS and the National Dairy Council, were showing their true colors. Prevention of cancer with low-cost, low-profit plant foods was not welcomed by the food and pharmaco-medical industries. With support from a trusting media, their combined power to influence the public was overwhelming. Personal consequences. The ending of this story, however, is a happy one. Although the AICR's first couple of years were turbulent and difficult for me, both personally and professionally, the smear campaigns finally started to wane. No longer considered on the fringe, the AICR has now expanded to England, the World Cancer Research Fund in London, and elsewhere. For over 30 years now, the AICR has run a program that funds research and education projects on the link between diet and cancer. I initially organized and chaired that grant program, and then continued as the AICR's senior science advisor for several years, in a few different stints after its initial founding. One more unfortunate affair, however, bears mention. I was informed by my Nutrition Society's board of directors that 2 society members, Bob Olson and Alf Harper, had proposed to have me expelled from the society, supposedly because of my association with the AICR. It would have been the first expulsion in the history of the society. I had to go to Washington to be interviewed by the president of the society and the director of nutrition at the FDA. Most of their questions concerned the AICR. The whole ordeal proved stranger than fiction. Expel a prominent society member, shortly after I was nominated to be the organization's president, for being involved with a cancer research organization. Later, I found myself reflecting on the affair with a colleague who knew the inner workings of our society, Professor Sam Tove of North Carolina State University. He, of course, knew all about the investigation, as well as other shenanigans. In our discussion, I told him about AICR being a worthy organization with good intentions. His response has resonated with me ever since. "It's not about AICR," he said. "It's about what you did on the National Academy of Sciences report on diet, nutrition, and cancer." When the NAS's report concluded in June 1982 that a lower intake of fat and a higher intake of fruits, vegetables, and whole grain products would make for a healthier diet, I had betrayed, in the eyes of some, the nutrition research community. Supposedly, as one of the two diet and cancer experimental researchers on the panel, it was my duty to protect the reputation of the American diet as it was. After my failure to do so, my subsequent involvement with the AICR and its promotion of the NAS report only made matters worse. Luckily, reason prevailed in this whole farcical encounter. A board meeting was held to vote on whether I should be expelled from my society, and I handily survived the vote, 6-0, with 2 abstentions. It was hard not to take all of this personally, but there's a larger point here, and it's not personal. In the world of nutrition and health, scientists are not free to pursue their research wherever it leads. Coming to the wrong conclusions, even through first-rate science, can damage your career. Trying to disseminate these wrong conclusions to the public for the sake of public health can destroy your career. Mine was not destroyed. I was lucky, and some good people stood up for me. But it could have gone much worse. After all of these numerous ordeals, I have a better understanding of why my society did the things it did. The awards funded by Mead Johnson Nutritionals, Letterly Laboratories, BioServe Biotechnologies, and previously Procter & Gamble and the Danon Institute, all food and drug outfits, represented a strange marriage between industry and my society. Do you believe that these friends of the society are interested in pursuing scientific investigation, no matter what the conclusions may be? Consequences for the public. Ultimately, the lessons I learned in my career had little to do with specific names or specific institutions, and more to do with what goes on behind the scenes of any large institution. What happens behind the scenes during national policy discussions, whether it happens in scientific societies, the government, or industry boardrooms, is supremely important for our health as a nation. The personal experiences I have talked about in this chapter, only a sample of such experiences, have consequences far greater than personal aggravation and damage to my career. They illustrate the dark side of science. The side that harms not just individual researchers who get in the way, but all of society. It does this by systematically attempting to conceal, defeat, and destroy viewpoints that oppose the status quo. There are some people in very influential government and university positions who operate under the guise of being scientific experts, whose real jobs are to stifle open and honest scientific debate. Perhaps they receive significant personal compensation for attending to the interests of powerful food and drug companies. Or perhaps they merely have an honest personal bias toward a company-friendly viewpoint. Personal bias is stronger than you may think. I know scientists with family members who died from cancer, and it angers them to entertain the possibility that personal choices, like diet, could have played a role in the death of their loved ones. Likewise, there are scientists for whom the high-fat, mostly animal-based diet they eat every day is simply what they learned was healthy at a young age. They love the habit, and they don't want to change. The vast majority of scientists are honorable, intelligent, and dedicated to the search for the common good rather than personal gain. However, a few are willing to sell their souls to the highest bidder. They may not be many in number, but their influence can be vast. They can corrupt the good name of institutions of which they are a part, and, most importantly, they can create vast confusion among the public, which often cannot know who is who. You might turn on the TV one day to see an expert praising McDonald's hamburgers, and then read a magazine the same day that says you should eat less high-fat red meat to protect yourself against cancer. Who is to be believed? Institutions also are part of the dark side of science. Committees like the PNIC and the American Council on Science and Health generate intellectually lopsided panels, committees, and institutions that are far more interested in promoting their point of view than in debating scientific research with an open mind. If a PNIC report says that low-fat diets are fraudulent scams, and an NAS report says the opposite, which one is right? In addition, this closed-mindedness in science spreads across entire systems. The ACS was not the only health institution that worked to make life difficult for the AICR. The National Cancer Institute's Public Information Office, Harvard Medical School, and a few other universities with medical schools were highly skeptical of the AICR, and in some cases, outright hostile. The hostility of medical schools at first surprised me, but when the ACS, a very traditional medical institution, also pitched in, it became obvious that there really was a medical establishment. The behemoth did not take kindly to the idea of a serious connection between diet and cancer, or, for that matter, virtually any other disease. Big medicine in America is in the business of treating disease with drugs and surgery after symptoms appear. This means that you might turn on the TV to see that the ACS gives almost no credence to the idea that diet is linked to cancer, and then open the paper to see that the AICR says what you eat impacts your risk of getting cancer. Who do you trust? Only someone familiar with the inside of the system can distinguish between sincere positions based in science and insincere, self-serving positions. I was on the inside for many years, working at the very top levels, and saw enough to be able to say that science is not always the honest search for truth that so many believe it to be. It far too often involves money, power, ego, and protection of personal interests above the common good. Very few, if any, illegal acts need to occur. It doesn't involve large payoffs being delivered to secret bank accounts or to private investigators in smoky hotel lobbies. It's not a Hollywood story. It's just day-to-day government, science, and industry in the United States. Chapter 14. Scientific Reductionism. When our 1982 National Academy of Sciences, NAS, Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Committee was deciding how to summarize the research on diet and cancer, we included chapters on individual nutrients and nutrient groups. This was the way the research had been done, one nutrient at a time. For example, the chapter on vitamins included information on the relationships between cancer and vitamins A, C, E, and some B vitamins. However, in the report summary, we recommended getting these nutrients from foods, not pills or supplements. We explicitly stated that these recommendations apply only to foods as sources of nutrients, not to dietary supplements of individual nutrients. The report quickly found its way to the corporate world, which saw a major money-making opportunity. They ignored our cautionary message distinguishing foods from pills and began advertising vitamin pills as products that could prevent cancer, arrogantly citing our report as justification. This was a great opening to a vast new market, commercial vitamin supplements. General Nutrition, Inc., the company with thousands of general nutrition centers, started selling a product called Healthy Greens, a multivitamin supplement of vitamins A, C, and E, beta-carotene, selenium, and a minuscule half gram of dehydrated vegetables. Then they advertised their product by making the following claims. The Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Report recommended we increase, among other things, our amounts of specific vegetables to help safeguard our bodies against the risk of certain forms of cancer. These vegetables recommended by the National Academy of Sciences report are the ones we should increase. Cabbages, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccoli, carrots, and spinach. Mom was right. Research scientists and technicians at General Nutrition Labs, realizing the importance of the research, instantly went to work to harness all of the vegetables and combined all of them into a natural, easy-to-take, potent tablet. The result is Healthy Greens, a new potent breakthrough in nutrition that millions of people can now help safeguard their well-being with. The greens that the National Academy of Sciences Committee recommends we eat more of. GNC was advertising an untested product and improperly using a government document to support its sensational claims. So the Federal Trade Commission went to court to bar the company from making these claims. It was a battle that lasted years, a battle that was rumored to have cost General Nutrition, Inc. about $7 million. The NAS recommended me as their expert witness because of my co-authorship of the report in question and because of my harping on this point during our committee deliberations. A research associate in my group, Dr. Tom O'Connor, and I spent 3 intellectually stimulating years working on this project, including my 3 full days on the witness stand. In 1988, General Nutrition, Inc., settled the false advertising charges relating to Healthy Greens and other food supplements by agreeing to pay $600,000, divided equally to 3 different health organizations. This was a small price for the company to pay, considering the ultimate revenues that were generated by the exploding nutrient supplement market. Focus on fat. The focus on individual nutrients instead of whole foods has become commonplace in the past 3 decades, and part of the blame can be put on our 1982 report. As mentioned, our committee organized the scientific information on diet and cancer by nutrient, with a separate chapter for each nutrient or class of nutrients. There were individual chapters for fat, protein, carbohydrate, vitamins, and minerals. I am convinced it was a great mistake on our part. We did not stress enough that our recommendations were concerned with whole foods because many people still regarded the report as cataloging the specific effects of individual nutrients. The nutrient that our committee focused on the most was fat. The first guideline in the report explicitly stated that high fat consumption is linked to cancer, and recommended reducing our fat intake from 40% to 30% of calories, although this goal of 30% was an arbitrary cutoff point. The accompanying text said, "The data could be used to justify an even greater reduction. However, in the judgment of the committee, the suggested reduction is a moderate and practical target and is likely to be beneficial." One of the committee members, the director of the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, Nutrition Laboratory, told us that if we went below 30%, consumers would be required to reduce animal food intake, and that would be the death of the report. At the time of this report, all of the human-based studies showing fat to be related to cancer, mostly breast and large bowel, were actually showing that the populations with more cancer consumed not just more fat, but also more animal-based foods and fewer plant-based foods. See Chapter 4. This meant that these cancers could just as easily be caused by animal protein, dietary cholesterol, something else exclusively found in animal-based foods, or a lack of plant-based foods, discussed in Chapters 4 and 8. But rather than wagging the finger at animal-based foods in these studies, dietary fat was given as the main culprit. I argued against putting the emphasis on specific nutrients in the committee meetings, but only with modest success. It was this point of view that landed me the expert witness opportunity at the FTC hearings. This mistake of characterizing whole foods by the health effects of specific nutrients is what I call reductionism. For example, the health effect of a hamburger cannot be simply attributed to the effect of a few grams of saturated fat in the meat. Saturated fat is merely one ingredient. Hamburgers also include other types of fat, in addition to cholesterol, protein, and very small amounts of vitamins and minerals. Even if you change the level of saturated fat in the meat, all of the other nutrients are still present and may still have harmful effects on health. It is a case of the whole, the hamburger, being greater than the sum of its parts, the saturated fat, the cholesterol, etc. One scientist especially took note of our focused critique of dietary fat and decided to test the hypothesis that fat causes breast cancer in a large group of American women. He was Dr. Walter Willett of the Harvard School of Public Health, and the study he used is the famous Nurses' Health Study. Starting in 1976, researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health enrolled over 120,000 nurses from around the country for a study that was intended to investigate the relationship between various diseases and oral contraceptives, postmenopausal hormones, cigarettes, and other factors such as hair dyes. Beginning in 1980, Professor Willett added a dietary questionnaire to the study. In 1984, he expanded the dietary questionnaire to include more food items. This expanded dietary questionnaire was mailed to nurses again in 1986 and 1990. Data now have been collected for over three decades. The Nurses' Health Study is widely known as the longest-running premier study on women's health. It has spawned three satellite studies, altogether costing $4 million to $5 million per year. When I give lectures to health-conscious audiences, upwards of 70% of the people have heard of the Nurses' Health Study. The scientific community has followed this study closely. The researchers in charge of the study have produced hundreds of scientific articles in the best peer-reviewed journals. The design of the study makes it a prospective cohort study, which means it follows a group of people, a cohort, and records information on diets before disease events are diagnosed, which makes the study prospective. Many regard a prospective cohort study as the best experimental design for human studies. The question of whether diets high in fat are linked to breast cancer was a natural outgrowth of the fierce discussion going on in the mid-1970s and the early 1980s. High-fat diets not only were associated with heart disease, the McGovern dietary goals, but also with cancer, the Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Report. What better study to answer this question than the Nurses' Health Study? It has a good design, massive numbers of women, top-flight researchers, and a long follow-up period. Sounds perfect, right? Wrong. The Nurses' Health Study suffers from flaws that seriously doom its results. It is the premier example of how reductionism in science can create massive amounts of confusion and misinformation, even when the scientists involved are honest, well-intentioned, and positioned at the top institutions in the world. Hardly any study has done more damage to the nutritional landscape than the Nurses' Health Study, and it should serve as a warning for the rest of science for what not to do. Carnivorous nurses. To understand my rather harsh criticism, it is necessary to obtain some perspective on the American diet itself, especially when compared with the international studies that gave impetus to the dietary fat hypothesis. Americans eat a lot of meat and fat compared to developing countries. We eat more total protein, and even more significantly, About 70% or more of our protein comes from animal sources. This fact means only one thing. We are consuming very few fruits and vegetables. To make matters worse, when we eat plant-based foods, we tend to eat a large amount of highly processed products that often have too much added fat, sugar, and salt. For example, the USDA's National School Lunch Program counts French fried potatoes as a vegetable. In contrast, people in rural China eat very little animal food. It provides only about 10% of their total protein intake. The striking difference between the two dietary patterns is shown in two ways in Chart 14.1. These distinctions are typical of the dietary differences between Western and traditional cultures. In general, people in Western countries are mostly meat-eaters, and people in traditional countries are mostly plant-eaters. So what about the women in the nurse's health study? As you might guess, virtually all of these women consume a diet very rich in animal-based foods, even richer than the average American. Their average protein intake is around 19% of calories, compared with a U.S. average of about 15 to 16%. To give these figures some perspective, the recommended daily allowance, RDA, for protein is only about 9 to 10%. But even more importantly, of the protein consumed by the nurses in this study, between 78% and 86% comes from animal-based foods, as shown in Chart 14.2. Even in the group of nurses that eat the lowest amount of total protein, 79% of it comes from animal-based foods. In other words, virtually all of these nurses are more carnivorous than an average American woman. They consume very few whole plant-based foods. This is a crucially important point. To get further perspective, we must return to the 1975 international comparison by Ken Carroll shown earlier in Charts 4.7 to 4.9. Chart 4.7 is reproduced in Chart 14.3. This chart became one of the most influential observations on diet and chronic disease of the last 50 years. Like other studies, it was a significant part of the reason why the 1982 Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Report recommended that Americans cut their fat intake to 30% of total caloric intake to prevent cancer. This report and other consensus reports that followed thereafter eventually set the stage for an explosion of low-fat products in the marketplace. Low-fat dairy products, lean cuts of meat, low-fat sweets, and snack foods. Unfortunately, the emphasis on fat alone was misguided. Carroll's study, like all the other international comparisons, was comparing populations that mostly ate meat and dairy to populations that mostly ate plants. There were many more differences between the diets of these countries than just the fat intake. What Carroll's graph really shows is that the closer a population gets to consuming a plant-based diet, the lower its risk of breast cancer. But because the women in the nurse's health study are so far from a plant-based diet, there is no way to study the diet and breast cancer relationship originally suggested by the international studies. Virtually no nurses eat a diet typical of the countries at the bottom of this graph. Make no mistake about it, nearly this entire cohort of nurses is consuming a high-risk diet. Most people who look at the nurse's health study miss this flaw because, as Harvard researchers will point out, there is a wide range of fat intake among the nurses. The group of nurses who consume the least fat eat 20 to 25% of their calories as fat, and the group of nurses who consume the most fat eat 50 to 55% of their calories as fat. At a casual glance, this range appears to indicate substantial differences in the overall nutritional value of their diets. But this is just not true, as almost all women uniformly eat a diet very rich in animal-based foods. That begs the question, how can their fat intake vary dramatically while they all uniformly consume large amounts of animal-based foods? Ever since low fat became synonymous with healthy, technology has created many of the same foods that you know and love without the fat. you can now have all kinds of low-fat or no-fat dairy products. Low-fat processed meats. Low-fat dressings and sauces. Low-fat crackers. Low-fat candies. And low-fat junk food, like chips and cookies. In other words, you can eat mostly the same foods as you did 25 years ago, while substantially reducing your fat intake. But you still retain the same proportion of animal and plant-based food intakes. In practical terms, this means that beef, pork, lamb, and veal consumption is decreasing, while lower-fat chicken, turkey, and fish consumption is increasing. In fact, by consuming more poultry and fish, people have been increasing their total meat intake to record-high amounts, while trying, and largely failing, to reduce their fat intake. In addition, whole milk is being consumed less, but low-fat and skim milk are being consumed more. Cheese consumption has increased by 150% in the past 30 years. Overall, we are as carnivorous now as we were 30 years ago, but we are able to selectively lower our fat intake if we so desire, due to the wonders of food technology. To illustrate, we need only to look at two typical American meals. Meal number one is served in a health-conscious home, where the main grocery shopper in the family reads the nutrition labels on every food item he or she buys. The result? A low-fat dining experience. Meal number two is served in a home where the standard American fare is everyone's favorite. When they cook at home, they make the meal rich. The result? A high-fat dining experience. Both meals provide roughly 1,000 calories, but are markedly different in their fat content. The low-fat meal, number one, contains about 25 grams of fat, and the high-fat meal, number two, contains just over 60 grams of fat. In the low-fat meal, 22% of the calories come from fat, and in the high-fat meal, 54% of the calories come from fat. The health-conscious home has managed to create a meal that is much lower in fat than the average American dinner, but they've done it without adjusting their proportionate intake of animal and plant-based foods. Both meals are centered on animal-based foods. In fact, the low-fat meal actually has more animal-based foods than the high-fat meal. In effect, this is how the nurses in the nurses' health study achieved such a wide variation in fat intake. Some nurses simply are more diligent about choosing low-fat animal products. Many people would consider the low-fat meal to be a triumph of healthy meal planning. But what about the other nutrients in these meals? What about protein and cholesterol? As it turns out, the low-fat meal contains more than double the protein of the high-fat meal, and almost all of it comes from animal-based foods. In addition, the low-fat meal contains almost twice as much cholesterol. See chart 14.5. An overwhelming amount of scientific information suggests that diets high in animal-based protein can have unfavorable health consequences, as can diets high in cholesterol. In the low-fat meal, the amount of both of these unhealthy nutrients is significantly higher. Fat versus animal food. When women in America, such as those in the Nurses Health Study and the billion-dollar Women's Health Trial, reduce their fat intake, they do not do it by reducing their consumption of animal-based foods. Instead, they use low-fat and non-fat animal products, along with less fat during cooking and at the table. Thus, they are not adopting the diets that were shown in the International Correlation Studies and in our Rural China Study to be associated with low breast cancer rates. This is a very important discrepancy and is illustrated by the correlation between the consumption of dietary animal protein and dietary fat for a group of countries. See chart 14.6. The most reliable comparison was published in 1975. It showed a highly convincing correlation of more than 90%. This means that as fat intake goes up in various countries, animal protein intake increases in an almost perfectly parallel manner. Likewise, in the China study, the intakes of fat and animal protein also show a similar correlation of 84%. In the nurse's health study, this is not the case. The correlation between animal protein and total fat intake is only about 16%. In the women's health trial, also including American women, it is even worse, at minus 17%. As fat goes down, animal protein goes up. This practice is typical of American women who have been led to believe that by decreasing their fat intake, they are changing to a healthier diet. A nurse consuming a low-fat diet in the Harvard study, like American women everywhere, is likely to continue eating large amounts of animal protein, as shown in meal number 1. See chart 14.4. Sadly, this evidence on the effects of animal-based food on cancer and other diseases of affluence has been ignored, even maligned, as we continue to focus on fat and other nutrients in isolation. Because of this, the nurse's health study, and virtually every other human epidemiological study published to date, have been seriously shortchanged in their investigations of diet and disease associations. Virtually all the subjects under study consume the very diet that causes diseases of affluence. If one kind of animal-based food is substituted for another, then the adverse health effects of both foods, when compared to plant-based food, are easily missed. To make matters worse, these studies often focus on the consumption of just one nutrient, such as fat. Because of these very serious flaws, these studies have been a virtual disaster for discovering the really significant effects of diet on these diseases. The 100-plus million-dollar results. So now that you know how I interpret the nurse's health study and its flaws, we should take a look at its conclusions. After more than $100 million and decades of work, there is no shortage of results. So, what are they? The logical place to start is, of course, the question of whether fat intake really is linked to breast cancer. Here are some of the findings, cited verbatim. These data provide evidence against both an adverse influence of fat intake and a protective effect of fiber consumption by middle-aged women on breast cancer incidence over 8 years. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a relationship between dietary fat and fiber and breast cancer risk. We found no evidence that lower intake of total fat or specific major types of fat was associated with decreased risk of breast cancer. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a relationship between reducing fat, whether it is total fat or certain kinds of fat, and breast cancer risk. Existing data, however, provide little support for the hypothesis that reduction in dietary fat composition, even to 20% of energy during adulthood, will lead to a substantial reduction in breast cancer in Western cultures. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a breast cancer association with fat, even when women reduced their fat consumption all the way down to 20% of calories. Relative risks for monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fat were close to unity. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a relationship between these good fats and breast cancer risk. We found no significant associations between intake of meat and dairy products and risk of breast cancer. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a relationship between meat and dairy consumption and breast cancer risk. Our findings do not support a link between physical activity in late adolescence or in the recent past and breast cancer risk among young adult women. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a relationship between exercise and breast cancer risk. These data are suggestive of only a weak positive association with substitution of saturated fat for carbohydrate consumption. None of the other types of fat examined was significantly associated with breast cancer risk relative to an equivalent reduction in carbohydrate consumption. Translation: the nurse's health study detected little or no effect on breast cancer when women substituted fat for carbohydrates. Selenium intake later in life is not likely to be an important factor in the etiology of breast cancer. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a protective effect of selenium on breast cancer risk. These results suggest that fruit and vegetable consumption during adulthood is not significantly associated with reduced breast cancer risk. Translation: the nurse's health study did not detect a relationship between fruits and vegetables and breast cancer risk. So, there it is, readers. Breast cancer risk does not rise with increased intakes of fat, meat, dairy, or saturated fat. Breast cancer is not prevented by increased intakes of fruits and vegetables, or reduced by exercise, either during the teenage years or during adulthood. Dietary fiber, monounsaturated fats, or polyunsaturated fats. Also, the mineral selenium, long considered to be protective against certain cancers, has no effect on breast cancer. In other words, we might as well conclude that diet is completely unrelated to breast cancer. I can understand the frustration of Professor Mayer Stampfer, one of the leading researchers in this group, when he was quoted as saying, "This has been our greatest failure and disappointment, that we have not learned more about what people can do to lower their risk." He was making his comment in response to an opinion that the single biggest challenge for the future is sorting out the mess of contradictory findings and lack of information on breast cancer. I applaud Professor Stampfer for his candor, but it's unfortunate that so much money has been spent to learn so little. Perhaps the most rewarding finding, ironically, was the demonstration that tinkering with one nutrient at a time, while maintaining the same overall dietary patterns, does not lead to better health or to better health information. Despite these challenges, Harvard researchers have been steadily cranking out their findings. Here are some from their slew of studies that I would consider as very troubling contradictions when comparing disease risks for men versus women. Men who consume alcohol 3 or 4 times a week have a lower heart attack risk. Men with type 2 diabetes who consume a moderate amount of alcohol have a lower risk of coronary heart disease. And yet, alcohol consumption increases breast cancer incidence by 41% for women consuming 30 to 60 grams a day of alcohol compared to non-drinking women. Apparently, alcohol is good for heart disease and bad for breast cancer. The husband can have a drink with dinner, but should never share it with his wife. Is this a difference between men and women, or is this a difference in response between heart disease and cancer? Do you feel more informed or more confused? Then there are those wonderful omega-3 fatty acids. Some types of fish contain relatively large amounts of these fats and have been getting their share of positive press these days. If you've heard anything about omega-3 fatty acids, it's that you need more of them to be healthy. Again, more Harvard findings. Contrary to the predominant hypothesis, we found an increased risk of breast cancer associated with omega-3 fat from fish. This increased risk was statistically significant and was associated with an increase of only 0.1% of the total dietary energy. Our findings suggest that eating fish once per month or more can reduce the risk of ischemic stroke in men. Data suggest that consumption of fish at least once per week may reduce the risk of sudden cardiac death in men, but not reduce the risk of total myocardial infarction, non-sudden cardiac death, or total cardiovascular mortality. In other words, fish may prevent some aspects of heart disease, but ultimately has no effect on mortality from heart disease or even heart attack risk. Is this yet another question of deciding which disease you fear the least? Or is this another man versus woman difference? Here's an even older story. We've been warned for a long time to cut down on our cholesterol intake, and it was largely for this reason that consumption of eggs was brought into question. One egg has a whopping 200 milligrams or more of cholesterol, which takes up a large proportion of our 300 milligrams recommended daily limit. So, what do the Harvard studies tell us on this time-worn issue. Consumption of up to one egg per day is unlikely to have substantial overall impact on the risk of coronary heart disease or stroke among healthy men